Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
It's fine. Thank you. Counsel, are you situated and ready to proceed? If our clerk will call the second case, please.
The court will now call Norvell Norman versus the State of Texas. And may it please the court, Mr. Blake Burns to argue for the appellant, Ms. Andrea Jacobs to argue for the state.
Mr. Burns.
Morning, my name is Blake Burns. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Norvell Norman. Now, in this case, Mr. Norman was living with his girlfriend at the time. His girlfriend's car breaks down. He then calls a mechanic that he's familiar with, that he's dealt with in the past, and has her car towed to his shop. He's never had a problem with this mechanic in the past, but on this occasion, the mechanic does the work. Mr. Norman goes in to sign for the work, brings a check issued from Mr. Norman's girlfriend's checking account, because it was her car. Signed by her, just the amount wasn't filled out. He then, it's undisputed on the record that Mr. Norman had no access to this account. Mr. Norman hands Mr. Howard, the owner of the shop, the check after he fills the rest of it out. And before Mr. Howard deposits the check, Mr. Norman's girlfriend had put a stop payment on the check. And that's why we're here today. Mr. Norman was convicted of theft of services by deception after a bench trial. Now, the case law is clear that no act of deception that occurs after the service is rendered can be legally sufficient to sustain a finding of guilt in a theft by deception of services. The deception has to have provoked the service. Now, in this case, the deception alleged and proved by the state at the trial court was that Mr. Norman passed a bad check to Mr. Howard. Now, the state's brief, they tried to argue that the deception happened prior to that, but we actually have some tangible proof that that's not what was proven at trial. And I'd like to direct the court's attention to a copy of the indictment, which I believe I've provided for the court. The trial judge was following along with the state, underlining and checking off what they had proven. Norvell Norman is underlined, County of Tarrant, state aforesaid on the 2nd of February. He underlined knowingly, and he skipped by deception or threat. He underlined by false token secured performance of a service. So we know, based on that, Mr. Norman was convicted of that check.
You know that just because that's what he underlined, that was all he took into consideration in making a finding of guilt. You know that.
Well, I think that's highly suggestive of that, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd hate for you to read the briefs that I'm underlined.
Me too.
Well, I frequently don't know why I underline them after I get through to look back at them.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's anything that he'd underlined or checked that wasn't an essential element in this case. So I think it's safe to assume that's what he was doing, following along with the state to make sure that they connected all their dots so that we wouldn't be here on this type of an issue.
But now, if the evidence is sufficient to find him guilty, really doesn't matter what the court's thought process was at the time, does it?
Well, the standard of proof is based on a hypothetically correct jury charge. Could any rational trier of fact decide that? But I think it's just noteworthy that it appears we are here because of the check, which is legally insufficient. Now, it doesn't 100% win our case for us, but I think it is noteworthy that the judge appeared to think that the check that was delivered after the services were rendered was sufficient in this case. And just in the state's brief, they've argued that the act of deception they're alleging happened at the beginning of the process, before Mr. Norman had even come in, before the shop had done anything. Now, just for the sake of argument, if that's what happened at trial, it's basically just based on the state imputing knowledge on the appellant of his girlfriend's bank accounts, which he had no access to. They've offered no proof that at the time he called that shop, he intended to deceive them into fixing the car. And in fact, that story is kind of nonsensical. If he's masterminding this plan to get one over on this shop owner and skip town before the guy finds out, why is he going to a mechanic that knows him, knows his father, knows where he lives, in order to deceive him? Now, I think from the evidence, we can kind of tell what happened in this case. There was a perfectly legally innocent explanation for everything that happened. Mr. Norman's girlfriend, her car broke down. She appointed him as the go-between between her and the mechanic because he had a CDL. He probably understood car issues more than she did. He negotiated with the mechanic. Mechanic said, here's the estimate. Now, Mr. Norman did a poor job of communicating that number to his girlfriend. She said, okay, here's a check. Just fill in the amount. He goes, gets the car fixed, fills in the amount, hands a check in person to the mechanic. You know, it doesn't appear that he's trying to get away with anything at this point. And like I said, he did a poor job telling her what that number was, because when he came home and told her what the number was, she said, oh my gosh, there's not that much money in my account. I'm going to stop payment on that check before it bounces. And then afterward, somewhere right around that time, the record reflects that she had moved to California. So now Mr. Norman is stuck at home with a girlfriend in California, a car that doesn't work, a mechanic that's angry at him, and a mechanic's bill that he can't possibly afford. And he just used the Homer Simpson plan of, I'm going to hide under a pile of blankets and hope that somehow everything works out. Now, that may make him a deadbeat, a coward, a jerk, but it doesn't make him a criminal. The state has offered no proof that he intended to deceive this shop before any services were rendered. By the time he actually agreed to the amount of payment, the record's clear that the services had already been rendered.
Wasn't it consistent with the estimate?
It was a little more, but it was consistent with the testimony about the estimate. I don't believe the estimate was made it into the record. It was consistent with the shop owner's recollection of the estimate.
Okay.
But on page 12 of volume 2, the shop owner testified that he came in, we showed him the parts of the car, and then we finalized the transaction. There was not an agreement to pay until the services were actually rendered in this case.
They were going to do it for free.
Well, could have negotiated a lower amount.
No, I ask you the intent of the parties. There wasn't any indication in evidence that this was to be a gratuitous repair on the vehicle, was there, Mr. Byrne?
No, Your Honor.
And your client had repairs done previously, so he knew in his mind that the repairs that were going to be done were going to be expected to be paid for.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, I didn't hear you mention the Odessa part of this whenever you were doing a summary a moment ago.
Well, the Odessa part, I think my client admitted that never happened.
Well, he lied about it. He told police officer that he had, that the car was out in Odessa and wouldn't run.
Yes, Your Honor. And he testified, I believe, that that was a result of him panicking after he found out his girlfriend stopped the payment on the check. You know, he, at the time, thought he had paid for everything. It wasn't until he left that shop and his girlfriend found out what the amount was that she stopped payment. Now he's in trouble.
Well, either way, he was going to be in trouble because if she didn't stop payment, it was going to bounce.
Correct.
Correct? And, I mean, I think the state's argument is that maybe he didn't have access to that account, but he knew what was in it because he provided her all the money that she got because she didn't work, and he paid for everything. So that would impute to him some knowledge of what's in that account, would it not?
Well, it'd impute with some knowledge, like you said, but that's making an assumption that he knows that exact balance. And the state also mentioned that she gets money from her parents all the time. She had a couple $1,000 refund check coming around that time. And there was
from
other,
him, or that was not a tax, from her.
Well, that was a tax refund.
Right.
So she had a tax refund. She was doing something for work. And she had other sources of income. And the state's asking the court to assume that he knew what they were. It was their obligation to prove that at the trial level, and they just failed to meet that burden. I think if there was some evidence that he knew that this payment wasn't going to go through, that would be legally sufficient. But the fact is, that wasn't presented at the trial court level. I believe that's all I have for the moment, unless the court has any further questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Jacobs, yes, please.
May it please the court. My name is Andrea Jacobs. I'm here on behalf of the state of Texas, the appellee in this matter. $33.27. That's how much was in the bank account when appellant agreed to the estimate of $3,900. $4.45. That's the amount that was in the bank account when he wrote in the amount on the check and then presented it for $3,917.33. Not a single deposit was made from the time appellant agreed to the $3,900 estimate to the time he presented the $3,917.33 check. But they were moving to California, and this was their only regular vehicle. It was not working. They also had three children they had to take care of, and they had no family vehicle. The state submits that the evidence is sufficient to support appellant's conviction for theft of service by deception. This court must view all the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution. Only then should it determine whether any rational trier of fact would have found the substantive elements of the criminal offense. In this case, the trial court was the exclusive judge of the facts, the witnesses' credibility, and the weight given their testimony. It was free to believe or disbelieve the testimony of the witnesses, including the defendant, and to reconcile conflicts in the testimony. It was also free to accept or reject any or all evidence on either side. Conflicts in the evidence without more is not enough to render evidence insufficient in support of a verdict. And finally, as long as the verdict is supported by a reasonable inference, it is within the province of the fact finder to choose which inference is most reasonable. A person commits the theft of service by deception if the defendant intentionally or knowingly, with the intent to avoid payment for a service that he knows is provided for only for compensation, secured the other person's performance of service by deception. I know that appellant argues in his brief and also up here that the check itself was the act of deception. And the cases he cited are all about how the check is alleged in the indictment as the act of deception. But this case is distinguishable. I believe it shows by the indictment, but also by the state's closing argument, that the act of deception was the negotiation beforehand, knowing very well that there was no intent to pay and there was an intent to avoid payment. If appellant had not promised to pay for the services, no services would have been rendered. I believe the evidence shows that even though the check was used as evidence of this overall intent, that the evidence was sufficient. I believe the trial court properly found that the appellant knew the balance of the checking account, even though the checking account was in Shuck's name, because they lived together with their three children. Appellant refers to her repeatedly as his girlfriend. Well, this is a woman who's been in his life for 12 years. They have three children. They live together. While he owned a transportation business, by his own testimony, she did not work outside the home. And he says that. He testifies to that. There's no question. She does not work. I provide her money. He discusses how she pays a lot of the bills, the electric bill, the phone bill, things like that, are shown by the bank records. And he admits that he would give her money so that she couldn't pay those bills. If you look at the bank records, she then deposited the money in the checking account. She paid for the household bills with that checking account. And cash deposits received to that bank account closely correlated with household bill payments. There is a testimony that she got money from her parents, but there's no indication as to how that came. She, there in California, if you look at the bank records, I believe in March or early April, there's an indication of a receipt of a deposit of a check about $1,000 or so. I may be off. It's between $1,000, $2,000. And that could be from the parents. But if you look at the records, what deposits have come in, they closely correlate in their cash deposits to the household bills. So I believe that that shows that they were discussing what the bills were. He was providing her money, as he testified to, and they were closely related, so he understood how much money was in there. Also, on February 7th, there was an IRS check. If she did not work, it doesn't say IRS check of Norval Norman, but if she did not work outside the home, yes, the state submits that that was his refund check. The state was sufficient. In addition to this trial court properly finding that he knew the information, that he was aware of the bank account, based on that, the court properly found that appellant intended to not pay when he agreed to pay for services. One, this is not her car. They own this car together. This is the car that she drove their children together. I know that she's lived here since 2005, moved here to be with him. There was some indication in the record that they were on again, off again, but they have three kids, and there's no indication that they've moved out from that 2005. At the time, appellant authorized the services to pay the promise of the estimate of $3,900. As we said, the checking account only had $33.27. It is possible he did not know the exact amount, but there's a big difference between $33 and $3,900. If you look at the bank records in the months preceding, I believe it's only about $360 had been deposited in that bank account. No deposits were made in that bank account, even though appellant knew that he was the one giving her money. From the time he authorized the $3,900 payment to the actual time when he wrote in $3,917.33 and presented that check for payment. And at the time, that account only had $4.45 in it. Shuck never had any interaction with the repair shop. And then when asked and confronted about the fact that this check had been stopped payment, and he testifies that he was aware of that, he lies and says, oh, the car broke down. We had to tow it. It was on the way to Odessa. We had to tow it to Odessa. And he's telling this to the officer on the phone. So the officer's like, okay, can I come to your house and talk to you? And they drive to the house, and of course, when he gets to the house, the car is there. And the car, that's when the appellant's like, well, yeah, I towed it from Odessa, and it's broken. And the officer's like, the appellant says, do you want to see? And the officer notes that the hood is broken, so he can't actually open it up, and he's wondering if maybe just a spark plug. And as we know, and as appellant pointed out, the appellant has a CDL. He had a transportation business, so he has some basic knowledge of vehicles. So I wouldn't think it would be that big for the officer to be concerned about that. So he lies about the Audi breaking down, and then when the officer says, hey, go talk to them, work it out. Do you guys have a relationship? Oh, no, I'll get a second opinion, and then never does anything. Appellant had pointed out that he and Shuck had started moving to California to the officer, that everything was in boxes. He couldn't find this tow receipt. So it wasn't just she was getting up and moving. They were moving together. The check preceding the repair shop one had bounced for insufficient funds, and it was the amount of $760, even though, again, that checking account only had $4. Appellant testified he never drove the vehicle, though he did own it. They owned it together, and also that he drove to the repair shop. And I believe there was testimony about his relationship with this repair shop and how he had brought in that car there before. He testified his only transportation was an 18-wheeler. He has three children and his girlfriend, baby mama, whatever we want to call her. They had a 12-year relationship. I want to say it's more than a girlfriend. They may not have held themselves out, so no common law wife, but I just, you know, this is the mother of his three children. And this was the only vehicle they had, and it didn't run. When brought to his attention that the check had been stopped, the demand of payment, it came in the form of voicemails that he received, and also that the officer, Sergeant Hamm, said, hey, you owe this money, there's been demand for payment. He did nothing. He didn't contact the repair shop. He didn't try to make amends. He didn't call them in the repair shop and say, hey, the car broke down. Can you try to fix it? Or I don't want to pay because of this. He made no effort, and in the end, the repair shop was never compensated. Viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, the trial court could have determined beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant had the intent to avoid payment when he authorized the services and agreed to pay the $3,900 estimate. The court could have also inferred that appellant and Shuck decided, since they were moving to California, they could get their car fixed and run out on the bill. And then, when appellant was confronted with the fact that they had stopped the payment, he lied about the car breaking down in Odessa in an attempt to mitigate the requirement to pay for those repairs. In short, the evidence was legally sufficient to prove that appellant intentionally secured auto repairs by deception because he promised to pay for services but intended to avoid payment, knowing that those repairs were provided only for compensation. Therefore, the state prays that the court overrule appellant's sole point of error and affirm the trial court's judgment.
Ms. Jacobs, what are the details on the $760 check you said preceding? Does that mean preceding in number in terms of check order?
Yes. I have no information other than the bank records that it was a $760. The check was number 1703, and this was check 1704.
And who was that $760 check made payable to?
There's no information in the record on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. I have plenty of time left, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The state, you know, once again, they keep talking about things that Sheila Shrunk knew, things that Sheila Shrunk did, nothing that Appella did until after the services had been rendered. This is an issue on proof. There was no proof presented at trial that he had any knowledge of that bank account, had no proof that he knew that check wasn't good. In fact, I think we have the opposite. You know, we see what happens when he found out it wasn't good. He was hiding low in his house, but he wasn't making any contact with this man. But when he thought that check was good, he showed up in person and handed it to him. And again, the state had the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And a rational trier of fact would have to believe that appellant knew that was going to happen. And it's just not in the record. With regard to the state mentioning in their closing argument that some deception occurred before the check, I believe in the state's brief they're saying it was the agreement to the estimate initially in the first phone call, I believe. The word in the 65-page record, the word estimate appeared 4 times, the word check 44 times. The state was proving the checkup. But even if it was the estimate, appellants provided the court with several cases where a check given after services rendered was not legally sufficient to support a conviction. I'm not aware of any cases where an acknowledgement of an estimate before work is rendered was sufficient to sustain a conviction on theft by deception. And I don't believe the state has provided that either. So based on the fact that the state just didn't show, I'm still not sure the exact act of deception they're alleging, but they sure didn't prove it at the trial court. And based on that, we'd ask that the court reverse the judgment of the trial court and enter a judgment of acquittal on behalf of the appellant. Thank you all.
Mr. Burns? Ms. Jacobs, Mr. Burns, thank you very much for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court.